Yeah, so the breakfast sandwich is a Guido Italian American hoagie roll with like real Italian ham on it, and that's a nice contrast. You know what I mean?
I don't really know what that means. Is that like the hoagie roll? Those are the really thick boys.
They're pretty
really
thick,
fluffy
yeah.
And they sell them.
They sell them here. It's a local bakery. They sell them here. A dozen of these large hoagie rolls. It used to be $2.99, and they were like the best value thing ever. I was like, they're great rolls. They only cost $2.99. I was like, what food inflation? What are you talking about? Now they're $3.99.
Oh well, that's it then.
That when the Cassoni's roll went up by a dollar, I was like,
okay, shit's getting real now.
We got to move some assets.
Okay,
you know what I mean? I was like, this thing of like buying foreign assets, took on new urgency for me when I saw the rolls go up by a dollar.
It's interesting. It's interesting how they're Italian rolls, but they're still relatively cheap. I feel like everything out here in LA, if it's Italian coded, that's just your permission slip to just print money.
Print money. Yeah, because Cassoni's is an Italian American thing, and so you got to think they're supplying New York City's bodegas. They're
right.
You know,
it's like a working class, just like a practical daily driver bread.
Italian.
Here it'd
be
sold in like Bristol Farms or some shit.
Yeah.
They wouldn't be sold by the dozen. They'd be sold a piece. It'd be like $4 a piece. A nice tasteful gold label.
I guess Guido isn't really a thing out in California.
No, it's not.
Working class Italian and, you know, Portuguese neighborhoods and stuff is not like a thing out in LA, I guess.
Nope. Here it's more the Lake Como set that wants to pay. I don't know. I don't know what's going on out there, but there's this little like Italian sandwich fad going down.
It's happening here, like Antica.
There's one that opened. Yeah, Al Antico Vinaio.
Yes.
Yeah. They opened up shop. There's a couple other places. They're all on the west side. And sandwiches can be like in the mid-30s.
Mid-30s? Whoa. Okay.
Yeah.
Damn,
yeah.
That's more than Katz's now. All right.
The Jewish deli situation is getting out of hand too.
You mean in terms of price?
In terms of price, yeah.
Katz's went up to $30. It's like, I was just talking to Shane about it yesterday. I was like, nobody, like someone was talking about, you know, like where to live in New York. And they were like, oh yeah, it's really close to Katz's. And I'm like, nobody goes to Katz's Deli. It's a complete tourist trap. It's like, well, I don't know about tourist trap because it is good. But like, no New Yorker I know of like regularly goes to Katz's for lunch.
It's like, it's right next to Katz. Yeah.
Yeah. You'll never
go. Yeah, I get it.
I mean, you know, it's only for
$30 actually, I think Cantor's Deli might have passed the $30 mark because they have a half sandwich that's over $20.
Is that the one near Echo Park?
Kind of.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. It's in a pretty rough looking kind of town. That's still expensive. That's another dislocation that I'm not prepared to deal with. My neighborhood is kind of getting that way too. Like, it looks hella run down. But there's going to be a shop selling like $13 scoops of ice cream and $400 bottles of perfume.
Really?
But there's literally like homeless people across the street from like a struggling like mini market, like Mexican mini market or something.
It's getting weird out there.
It is getting weird. And then like, okay.
It's
well,
like
maybe
the gentrification's almost not fully, it's almost like it's losing its power or something.
It's buffering. Uh-huh. So you're getting weird packet loss here and there. It's very strange. And then I'll think like, oh, okay, I can't go into a neighborhood in LA and kind of have a sense for are rents rising or falling? Because it looks like it's kind of doing both at the same time. It's a strange thing. So I basically just stopped eating out.
You know what? Me too. Eating out is a very special thing now.
Like,
you know, it's like a It's kind of like going out to a movie, which I haven't done in years, by the way. I haven't been to a movie theater in over 2 years. But yeah, like going out is special. It's not, you know, it's not like a regular thing anymore.
Yeah, it used to be. I mean, when I was working, you know, I had more money than time, basically. That's the equation there, right? So it'd be like, oh, it's Wednesday and I don't feel like going through all that. Let's just get dinner on the way home.
Sure.
Or stop by and get a burrito or something.
Yeah.
I used to really like going to see live music, and it was pretty easy to do back then. Mm-hmm. Like back in my day. And I literally mean like 5 years ago.
Okay.
Maybe a little longer, but it'd be easy to just kind of get a quick bite, maybe a drink, go to a venue, pay like 10, 15 bucks cover or something or a ticket. Ooh, go see some music. Like it won't be.
What kind of venues are we talking about here? Anything cool?
Like a lot of like multi-purpose venues. Sometimes they'll have like open mic nights for comedy. Some nights they'll just have just rented out to, I guess, a couple of local acts. Okay. So I never really know, like, cool. I've discovered a couple people that way, a couple of groups that way, but like, wow. I never know who's playing. I just go because I just want to go hang out.
Damn, you're living it. That sounds cool as hell. Yeah. All right.
See, that was cool as hell. So like dinner, maybe, you know, if it's a proper sit down thing, maybe like 20 bucks or something per person, maybe a little bit more if you're getting a drink or something. Ticket to go to the thing is like 10, 15 bucks. So you're kind of like in and out. You just have an evening out for about $50-ish.
Okay. Yeah.
Like you can't do, like, I'm not going to do that every day, but if for like just to chill out for a while, that's
pretty reasonable.
Fine. It's pretty reasonable. Now it's like,
given what you get, right?
Huh?
Well, given what you're getting in return.
Right. Yeah. And now every single part of that equation has changed now. Like food's super expensive, drinks are super expensive, and the bottom just kind of fell out of like the art scene in LA, which sounds crazy. There just aren't very many groups performing. I don't know if they've all just moved online or something, or I don't really know if anyone out there understands what's going on. I would love to know, because this is LA, and we're talking about LA not having enough like art.
I mean, I think New York City is the same. A lot of people are making the same complaint about New York City.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is even more surprising, because LA to me is a lot about entertainment and media, whereas New York City was supposed to be having a thriving arts scene.
Rock and roll, music.
Yeah. But also, I mean, I'm not really that plugged into the scene, but I think, it's not, it doesn't seem as vibrant as it used to be. I've been trying to go out more to see live shows and one of our friends is doing a cabaret, which is a throwback format, I guess. I'm planning to go see that. And so we'll see. I don't know. But yeah, I'm with you. I think it's also very expensive to go out to.
I think the last time I tried was about 3 years ago. First of all, the restaurant I wanted to go to near this little theater that I like, it shut down. So that's already, you know, signal number one.
That a thing? I feel like a lot of times I see restaurants that I look them up and I'm like, oh man, that place looks awesome. Closed. Mm-hmm. Like the second it's awesome, you're like, then you look it up, it's fucking closed.
There's restaurants that I put on my list to try, and then they close in like a year, especially if they tried to open post-pandemic. Forget about it. I feel like the only restaurants that are kind of surviving are the ones that like literally bought their land 70 years ago.
Yeah.
So that's the only so they can control that cost somewhat.
Yeah. Or are on a current like top 10 list somewhere.
They're
having their moment in the sun, which will eventually and almost inevitably burn out rather quickly these days.
Yeah.
And then you have a tier of restaurant that's are like kind of built, like they're baked into the wealthy. They have like a baked in wealthy patron set.
Yeah.
And they'll survive, but because they have a celebrity, like a Jean George type thing. And
Yeah, you know, but like,
else
come
is just
on,
fucking fair game, you know? Like,
the food is not great at those places too. If you're courting a wealthy audience, the food is not exactly going to be. I mean, there's going to be those restaurants that really, you know, swing for the fences, and they're going to be the once in a lifetime places. But like if you just go to an average Italian joint in Beverly Hills or something, you're not going to remember this meal while you're eating it. So I think the last 3 years ago. I just stopped for a burrito at a shack next to it because I need to eat. I ended up paying like $18 for a very average burrito.
Yeah.
So that already set the mood. That already soured the mood. And then when I got to the place, the guy at the door, the bouncer ticket guy combo dude is like, you're going to have to download this app.
What?
To buy the tickets online, because they just somehow not doing that.
They don't have like a box office anymore, that kind of thing.
I didn't wait to find out. Like, absolutely in no way, shape, or form am I downloading an app to go see a no name act at 9 p.m. on like a Thursday.
It's almost like doing that is an old way of life that's disappearing, and everything's getting appified. And it's like, is even having like a someone in the ticket booth going to be, you know, a remnant, a relic of an old world, and that experience is going to just be gone, that you can't buy a ticket from a person anymore, you know, behind a glass booth with that little metal circular voice vent, you know, and that voice portal. And oh man,
yeah, I mean, even movie theaters don't have that anymore. They're all on, you know, you always pre-buy or something. They always want you to get on their, like, their little rewards program or something.
Little bits of our world disappearing and then realizing that it's not going to make it. It's not going to come with us into the future.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like they got rid of the ticket guy job, but they also got rid of, like, live music. So it's the entire thing is just fading out in front of our eyes.
Very sad.
But the last big ticket movie I went to go see in the theater was Oppenheimer. So I guess that was like 2 years ago. I went to a late show.
Avatar 2 for me.
Yeah. Was that good? Did you like it?
Yes, I did. It's really good. Okay. That's all I can say about it. I don't remember too much about it other than I thought it was excellent.
Yeah, I mean, I saw a tweet that kind of stuck with me. Like, James Cameron just comes in like once every 10 years to print $1 billion and then bounces.
Yeah, and everyone kind of forgets about it.
Yeah, and then for all the, like, Avatar just does, just bonkers. Breaks new records.
Yeah.
And then cultural memory. Yeah, you probably remember that tweet too. Like, yeah, that's spot on. That's exactly what it is.
One theory is that his movies are a little bit too, his movies are a little bit too radical. And because they have overt political messaging. And the villains in Avatar are intentionally meant to resemble the United States military.
Sure.
And so it has this sort of like anti-military, somewhat anti-US messaging. And so that's why I think it doesn't get as much purchase in the secondary culture markets. You know what I mean? Like, in the way that other franchises do, where in between movies, there's this whole, there's a rabid fan base. And I'm starting to realize, like, I think a lot of that stuff may have to occur with sort of official sanction. Otherwise, I think with Avatar, you know, there's not as much encouragement by the studio and stuff to, like, get to sort of expand that universe. That's my feeling.
That makes sense, because like George Lucas is not shy about saying who the Empire is in Star Wars.
Yeah, but it's not as overt. It kind of still looks still vaguely Nazi, like the new ones too, with like the new First Order or whatever, like very sort of like aggressive, blatant Nazi imagery.
Sure.
So they're just like, they're not Americans. These are Nazis. Don't forget. I'm not saying that these are Americans.
Yeah. And Lucas himself is kind of out. So it's not like he gets to even have a say in the.
Yeah.
You're probably right.
Yeah.
You're probably right.
That's what I think. I mean, I know there's a whole that pod Chapo Trap House. They've gone into like why they're such big fans of of Box Office Jim and Avatar in particular, and how Avatar basically culminates with the mass death of like U.S. Marines.
Sort
of a heroic climax, you know, and I think that there's something to that idea. I do think there's something a little bit too anti-military and anti-US about the imagery, if not the themes, but the imagery of Avatar and the military aspects of it, especially they just seem too American. But anyway, sorry, weird aside, but
I forget where I was going with that.
Just like how we were talking about how like a lot of things from like the current world, like the older world are like disappearing and everything's being appified. And I don't know. I think at least one of the really deep root causes of this is just rising rents. Like
it's got to be the foundation.
It's a combination of rising rents in the real world, which just always go up. They never go down, you know, to the point where, and I don't understand, I still don't fully understand this, though I know a lot has been reported about it, but like, you'll see storefronts that just go empty for like a decade, and the landlord doesn't seem to give a shit.
It's creepy. I think I rant about this periodically, but there's all these strip malls that have like 40% occupancy.
Yeah.
It's like walking through a ghost town. And it's been that way for years and years and years.
Yeah, it's not for lack of people wanting to open up shops. I think the rent is probably just too high and they just won't drop it.
It's got to be a tax thing. Like, you can harvest losses from rent against your taxes. So it incentivizes people to keep the rents high and not really care so much if there's no occupant.
Yes, I've heard it's a combination of that and also your assets are valued at based on your rental income for ones that are leased out. And so if you drop the rent, the sort of like overall value of your real estate asset goes down, and then you might trigger loan covenant breaches where the asset like value coverage does not, the ratios get triggered. Like, basically, if you have a write down in value, then you might have to post additional collateral on your loan.
That makes sense, because these things are all built on hella leverage.
Yes, they're all built on CMBS and you know, all that stuff, the commercial real estate loans.
I don't know how that plays out for, because one mall that I'm thinking of, it's a Chinese built mall, but it's been there for like 30 years.
Wow. Yeah.
And
just so, like, relatively empty.
That's the one I was thinking of when I said 40% occupancy. Like, the majority of storefronts are completely empty. I mean, 30 years out, how much of a loan obligation can a building like that have? Anyway, I know we have real estate raccoons in the chat. I'd actually really like to know.
Yeah, like how this works, right?
Yeah, or how it doesn't work specifically now. But, you know, that's the business side aside. I can see how rising rents, the cost of living, just makes everybody more risk averse. Like, you need low cost of living to have a couple of kids get together and say, hey, you know what? Let's just fuck around and make a band.
Yeah.
Let's just do some street theater or something, see where it goes. You don't have room to say, let's just kind of fuck around for a while. You have to say, like, what college are you going to? What are you going to major in? Which bank are you going to work at?
Yeah. And you're up against social media. You're up against, you know, where like people are spending their time now, which is online.
Yeah.
Like, to convince people to come out to a show for a band they've never heard of, especially among the younger generation that never got into that habit, like, good luck, you know, convincing them. They're going to need to see a lot of hype online first to even bother going to that. And by the time that happens, then you're talking about something where the tickets are minimum, you know, $130 or something, because there's so much hype around it. It's going to be at a major venue and whatever. But the sort of like more indie scene, where people can be more experimental and they go to, like what you said, they go to sort of like, you know, sort of more divey locations and stuff. I feel like that's dying. I don't know, because I don't really go out very much.
I'd say it's dying. So, I mean, a couple of months ago, I kind of went out with a friend because he was saying like, he used to work in the music industry out here in LA, like did did sound production, post-production. So he knew a lot. And he had a bunch of places that he had kind of like wanted to go to.
Yeah.
So we just drove around. It was a hilarious night. We were playing good music in the car. And then we went to like four or five places. All five of them had gone under.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Wow. Cause it was just like bouncing from one place to another that he had remembered from years past. And then one just turned into this like hipster late night coffee bar with everybody's just looking like they're strung out on heroin, except they're not.
Mm-hmm. But no,
you know,
music.
That kind of like no music, completely like hipster farmhouse remodel, like a comedy club turned into like it just went under and was like a lingerie shop, you know, one of those like seedy sex toy shops.
Mm-hmm. That's a throwback. Yeah, it's like, hey, all right,
like okay, fuck the fuck it move,
yeah.
It was kind of shocking to see it kind of laid out that starkly all at once.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I'd say it's pretty dead. And the things that replace it, it's interesting that they're all safer bets, like guaranteed to make some money kind of bets. Like you take one was supposed to be a bar where like struggling actors was called Residuals.
Oh, okay.
Because like actors would just like come and then, you know, when they get their first gig, they like the rite of passages, you staple it to the wall. So so it's for Hollywood types, but like not the A-listers basically.
Mm-hmm.
They had completely stripped all that down and it looked like a hipster barbecue joint. And then we asked like, I wanted to see the residuals checks. And then I asked the guy at the front, like, oh, they saved some of them and it's hanging in the men's room.
Mm.
Like, wow. That's some disrespect. Wow.
The Chinese and like, social media app is eating everything in its path. It's eating everything in its path.
Yeah. And same for food. Probably you got to get on the hype wagon online to get anywhere, which means that you're now trapped to satisfying the whims of Gen Zers who don't have very much money, to begin with. And their attention span is limited. So it's a pretty savage game.
Do you notice this, like when you go out to eat or when you're out driving or something in the city, like or walking, like there'll be this huge line for like one restaurant and there's all these like Gen Z, like early Gen Z or sorry, older Gen Z or like younger millennial types lining up out the fucking door around the block for one restaurant and everything else in the area is completely ignored.
Dude, yeah, it is. It's next level. The boba wars.
When I see that, I fucking hate it.
It's really bad.
Yeah, it's just so annoying. It's so annoying when I see that because I'm like, the online shit is creating monoculture, and all of you motherfuckers are just chasing trends. And I know all of you are gonna post that shit online you don't even want to eat it. You just want to show that you were there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I'm sure you want to eat it too, but there's a lot of other things that you could want to eat. And if you were actually imaginative, because I know in LA, a lot of foodie culture started in LA. And I think it started when, if I understand, like people started going to neighborhoods that they typically wouldn't have, like ethnoburbs, you know, mostly Hispanic or Asian or whatever. And they would try restaurants just because they never heard of it before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or this one looked cool or, you know, whatever. So they would do that. They would actually go and discover new restaurants on their own. But then what would happen is like it gets hyped online and then everyone just wants to go to that one. Mm-hmm. Totally against from what I view as the spirit of the original idea, which is go out and try new shit that you never heard of.
Right. You I credit that one to Jonathan Gold.
Yeah.
Rest in peace.
Yeah, he's the LA Times food critic.
Yeah.
Food writer, I guess. Excellent.
Food writer, just basically like a cultural commentator. He was a tremendous influence and he seems like a really good guy. So he really had a good, you know, handle on how to direct people and how they should fucking act in these places too.
Yeah, he wasn't a snob, really, right? Like he seemed to genuinely just love food.
Yeah, and just he was willing to just get in his car and drive past the 110 freeway to go to places that LA Times writers weren't supposed to go.
Right.
Basically.
Right. And he blew the doors off of all that shit and he made it cool, right?
Like, yeah. But if you were an actual like Jonathan Gold fan, you're not going to just social media wasn't quite what it was to begin with, so I won't say it's all him, but there was a little bit of like inbuilt respect built into the approach. Like, I am a stranger here, I'm a guest, and I want to like enjoy, respect, and learn a thing or two.
Yeah.
Because I'm curious now. Mm-hmm. As opposed to now, like I need it for the gram.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, places here, like, especially boba, I think, is really intense in my neck of the woods. I think there's little fad foods that pop up elsewhere, too. I think, like, cookies is a big thing out over on the west side. But boba is where the fire is hottest in the Asian hoods. There's this small, like, cramped Chinese mini mall that had this boba joint come over from Taiwan. I knew the lines were going to be long, so I didn't bother with for the first like 2-3 years. After 3 years, I thought, okay, it's going to be normal now. The lines were still intense.
Wow.
And the crazy thing, so I didn't want to wait an hour in line for $9 tea.
Yeah.
And then literally the same plaza, there's like 3 other tea joints.
Yeah. That are ignored.
Yeah. Yeah. So I went to one of those and had a pretty good cup of tea. I don't know. How good can tea be? And then I noticed that the Instagram famous one, there's this like spot. They make backdrops built into the shop. So you can hold your tea against one of them. And then like their logo is it shows up in the background, or some snappy like motto or caption or something, you know, all done in like hipster neon and stuff. So you just see like kids crowding around taking pictures of their tea.
Yeah.
Like something is just fucking wrong.
I think it's very infantile, you know, where children are very susceptible to fad pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, like it's said that, you know, oh hey, everyone's wearing Reebok. This shows how old I am. When I was a kid, they're like, everyone's wearing Reeboks this year with the pump. And then every kid there goes home. They want Reeboks with pumps, you know, like,
sure.
And or this toy gets hot and everyone wants this toy or whatever. And it's like that now. Like, consumerism is so infantile. And then the Labubu thing. Everyone's got the Labubu, and everyone's got the fucking Dubai chocolate. Now they have Dubai chocolate Labubu, and it's like children. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's so infantilizing. And I feel like there's this harmless aspect to it. People are like, yeah, it's just for fun. It's just for fun. Yeah, it is just for fun. But on the other hand, that is like the dominant mode of like consumerism now. And these are multi-billion dollar industries. And it's going to come, and it's literally transforming the city landscape. The cityscape, it's changing the cityscape. And everyone's like, it's just a little spot of fun. And yeah, I guess, but it's also, you're being manipulated. I think a lot, we're being intentionally manipulated into this stuff. And it's ruining our cities. That's my opinion. You know, it's a combination of, you know, how difficult it is now to just do an organically sort of like self-sustaining business out in the real world, making real food, or you know, what, offering real services, versus, you know, having to pay ridiculous rents that keep going up every year, and they would, with landlords that would rather have them just be empty so it doesn't affect their asset value and they get tax breaks and stuff. This is our read of it. If there's other reasons, tell us. You have to compete against that, plus the fact that everything's moving online. And if you're starting a business these days, I mean, I feel like it's just assumed that you're going to do it virtually online. Like, why would you go through the headache of having to negotiate a commercial rent, worrying about, you know, employment issues and regulations and getting all that set up? The overhead is just not worth it. It just, it can't be worth it.
Yep.
You know? So, yeah, I don't know. I don't know what to, you know, even In-N-Out is, the owner of In-N-Out is leaving California.
Really?
Yeah, she's moving to Tennessee. They're going to
like
have
moving the headquarters or just like her person, her and her family personally?
I think her and her family, but I think they're going to take a significant number of people with them.
Well, okay.
There's still be headquarters. I think they're going to move their headquarters to Baldwin Park, wherever that is.
Oh, that's not too far from me. Yeah, that's where their original In-N-Out store is.
Yes.
So they're moving. Museum now.
So what I understand, because this is a New York Post, I just read it. Like, apparently they're moving out of Irvine and back to Baldwin Park, but at the same time, like the owner family, she's gonna be in Tennessee permanently.
Interesting.
And she had a lot to say about California and how awful it is and how dangerous. Like, they had to close one in Oakland just because bullets were literally flying through the restaurant. And they felt like they couldn't keep their employees safe. And then I think a lot of the COVID stuff like really hit them pretty hard, like all the regulations and stuff. So.
I mean, I will say In-N-Out is consistently, a home run out here.
Yeah.
In-N-Out's been building like crazy the past couple of months. I know I've been passing by at least 3 new locations, giant ones. Do you guys have a Raising Cane's out there?
Yeah, it's gotten pretty popular out here.
Yeah, you know how I don't know, like, out here, they get massive. Like 3 or 4, simultaneous lane drive-thrus.
Wow.
For
chicken tenders? I don't get it.
I've been there once, and honestly, I don't really even see the big deal about Chick-fil-A if we're really going there.
Neither do I. I've been to Chick-fil-A, I've been to Raising Cane's, and I've never wanted to go back. It's fine. I don't have a problem with them, but I do not understand the hype at all. I don't get
it.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't get it. Yeah. And I feel like In-N-Out is kind of competing with that. So yeah. I see there's one new location I drive by pretty often. And they're really trying to, like, I think it's like a 3-lane thing. It's the biggest In-N-Out I've ever seen. So it's surprising, but not altogether unexpected that they're shaking it up at the company. I know there's been huge family drama in the In-N-Out empire.
Yeah, she kind of went into that a little bit. I think that led to them leaving Irvine. But I don't know. There's just so much about this. Like, I remember I met some friends. We were, you know, we would often meet up after work and someone would pick a place to eat, you know, just check it out. And so we went to this place. It was a Taiwanese fried chicken place, hipster, sort of like hot at the moment. And we had to line up like it was a fucking club.
Oh, dang.
And we get in there and the whole thing is run very hipstery, very sort of like high concept, like purple, blue LED lighting and, you know, whatever.
Oh, yeah.
And so we order whatever we're going to eat. And I'm like, this has nothing to do with Taiwanese fried chicken at all. Right. Mm-hmm. Like, none of this Taiwanese fried chicken is, I don't even know what exactly they mean by that. But to me, it's these big like chicken schnitzels that they sell on the street with where they have the chicken schnitzel is like bigger than your face. That's what they call
it. Oh, yeah.
Sized schnitzels. But this,
to me, the only definition is has to have that like that light tapioca crust and the fried basil and the five spice.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's exactly it. Yeah, that very crusty, gravelly starch. Yes. And but this place my friend ordered something the hottest, the go-to dish that everyone puts on the gram or whatever. It comes. It's a pink glazed donut with a fried chicken in the middle.
Sandwich. What the fuck?
And I'm like,
oh,
okay. This is a child's idea of food.
Uh huh.
Do you know what I mean? Like, this is what a kid would dream up of. You know, like, a donut and fried chicken. Like, you know, it's retarded. And
it's gimmicky carnival food shit, like at a county fair. They're like, hey, deep fried butter.
Yep, that's exactly what it's like. Which is funny. If you go to Taiwan, actually, the street food scene, which has become, you know, legendary now, like a lot of people, it's like that. It's really it's much worse than it used to be, in my opinion. The people have told me I've gone to the wrong places, but the ones I've gone to, it's very much like going to a carnival for food. It's, you know, and there's no variety anymore. It's like the same six or seven like roving franchises that sell the same thing, and everything is it's a volume war where everything's pumped up to 11, and it's just everything is super decadent and meant to grab your attention. It's not really good. It's not good food. It's very like loud and attention grabbing food.
I get it. There was a really hyped, they're starting to do more street fair, like night market kind of events out here, which I get, but
I
can't stand them, honestly. For one thing, they never pick a place that has enough parking. I mean, that's not so much a problem for you guys, I suppose, but out here, like, you live and die by the car. So my friends really wanted to go, and then we went with enough time to spare too. We went pretty early. We had to park like a 30-minute walk away just because it was in this inaccessible little place where and all the sidewalks had like five different contradicting, like, no parking signs. So it was a 30-minute walk. It was kind of hot. We get there again. It's like a seedy carnival. And the food was really expensive.
So it kind of feels like you're at you're eating at a concert, but there's no concert. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It sucks. I don't get it.
Yeah, there was like a shitty DJ in the corner kind of doing his own thing. And then I ended up paying like $15 for a tiny little egg sandwich or something. It was just, and then I got thirsty. Oh, you couldn't bring your own, like, beverages in, so I had to pay $8 for tea, that sort of thing.
They commercialize what you say. Like, the whole point of the street food scene is that it's cheap and relatively, you can get a lot of different food in one place because, you know, the overhead is so low. But they're taking the experience of it and reselling it back to you, but without the original purpose. And,
right.
You know what I mean?
Huge markup for novelty.
Huge markup. Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken, the night markets are like the shijang are in Korea. You literally, that's just like, literally you come off work and you walk through and buy a couple of things to eat for dinner. It's a lively scene, but it's not supposed to be an event. It's not supposed to be like a whole thing. And the idea is that
it's part of the landscape.
It's part of the culture. And the deal is that it's easier and cheaper than going home and cooking for yourself.
Right.
That's the trade. That's the trade you're making here.
Yep.
And then in return, you get like you get to sit with other people. There's lights. There's a little bit of hustle and bustle. So you don't have to feel like you're eating all alone in your own apartment or something.
Yeah.
But here it's like every single benefit or every single one of the reasons why those existed in the motherland to begin with, they completely inverted.
Yes. Yep. Yeah.
The last one I went to was a Thai thing, and they were having some like beauty pageant. So it's a whole bunch of like teenage girls in skimpy bikinis walking up and down a little stage.
Yeah.
And pad Thai is $22.
Yeah.
Like, why am I here?
Because I think what they're doing, it's kind of like a Disney World thing where they're like, Disney World originally was supposed, or Disneyland, I guess, but Disney World too, was originally meant to be sort of like a sort of exotic simulacrum of an exotic vacation for middle class families that can't afford to like fly to Europe or, you know, do some, you know, they wanted to open up the vacation field a little bit more, offer the middle class family a little bit something more than just a road trip to another town, but at the same time not go all the way to like fly across an ocean. But now it's kind of become its own thing, like a Disney World thing. You go there in lieu of going to Europe. You know what I mean?
Right.
And I just feel like a lot of things got inverted that way. I feel like with the night market and stuff, at least the way they market it here, you know, they'll call it the Taiwanese night market or they say whatever. And it's making clear references to city life, city street life in Asia for a diaspora and maybe like a hipster crowd that wants to recreate their sort of like vacation to Asia.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like it's not,
yeah.
You're not taking the economics and idea of Asian street food and importing it into the United States in a way that replicates the purpose of it, like the economics and the purpose of it. You're just it's just a vibe to make you feel like you're on vacation in like Asia. And first of all, it does a bad job of that itself.
Mm-hmm.
And it certainly serves none of the purposes that you were talking about, which is actually to like kind of embed itself into daily life and become, you know, a form of like domestic convenience.
Mm-hmm.
It's just this weird spectacle event. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah, what sealed the deal? It's good you mentioned that. There's one that's been around for a while, so it kind of became an institution. It's called the 626 Night Market, literally.
Uh-huh.
And then after the pandemic, you know, like a lot of people just decided to like sell dumplings out of their home. Some of them might have set up some carts or something.
Sure.
There was an actual little night market scene that was actually starting to pop up, like behind restaurants or markets or something.
Oh, yeah.
The 626 Night Market Incorporated went in and shut all those down.
Because it wanted to
they wanted people to draw in to their like once, I think it's once a month or once every other month, they pick a giant venue and then just have their event. They didn't want the little mom and pop carts cutting into that action. So they would like they would literally go in and like call in the city to shut down the actual little like market scene that was happening organically around town.
Wow.
Yeah.
This is like Dave Chang trying to copyright fucking sriracha sauce or whatever he tried to do.
Did he
do
really
weird shit like trying to monopolize the chili sauce business or something?
When you're that high, anything sounds like a good idea. I wouldn't be surprised. Sure.
It's all about the fucking money. I'm telling you.
It's all about
the
brand integrity.
Money. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, and God help you if you try to use like night market in any of your branding, if you're going to be fighting against the 626 night market.
That is so disgusting.
Yeah.
I mean, I could totally see that. And I can totally see there being these little, you know, grind culture entrepreneurs behind these things. And they're sitting, you know, immediately you meet with a little success and suddenly they like self-MBAify. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They self-MBAify and they start talking about the brand. They start talking about, you know, like the pricing power and all this shit. And you're like,
mm-hmm.
Oh God, why can't we have nice things? You know, and it's built into everyone's fucking mind that, you know, we should support high margin, high profit businesses because that's inherently good.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, no, they're just taking advantage of you.
Right.
But they want to be taken advantage of. That's the thing is, like, I think this whole online culture, I guess in Chinese they call it Wang Hong, like web famous, Wang Hong culture.
Okay.
Which I think is a good term. I don't know if we necessarily, maybe it's like viral culture.
Is that virality? Is that what that means?
Yeah, it kind of refers to, you know, I think Wang Hong means, it's kind of my interpretation of, so Wang is web and like, you know, internet, and Hong is like famous. So it just means web famous. It kind of is from my, how I've heard and used the term, is a way for normie people to explain why this one restaurant out of all the ones in this area has a line wrapped around the block and nothing else does. And that is like, that is Wong Hong. It's like, obviously this thing blew up online as some sort of meme and now everyone's going to it. And I feel like that culture is driven by some very negative tendencies. And one of them is this shut up and take my money feeling. Like, everything, you know, they don't, nobody gives a shit about value. Nobody gives a shit about anything. They just want to prove that they're part of the online conversation, that they know, you know, they're not going to waste their time on like the stupid taco place that no one cares about. They want to go try the real thing.
Sure.
You know, and it's all this inverted shit. And I don't know. I feel really sorry for people trying to start a business. You know?
Oh, it's real, yeah.
Because now everything's got to be NBA fight. You can't just be like, you know, a person that runs a restaurant. You've got to have all this marketing gimmicks.
You have to be your own little like chief marketing officer. You got to have your little army of influencers to get. If you're opening a brick and mortar store, like you have a bit of a suicidal streak in you.
Yeah, I am very, I don't know, I'm very opposed now to this trend of following trends online. And it's just sad because like that's not its origin. Do you know what I mean? Like even the culture that they're trying to promote, like this sort of food truck culture or, you know, whatever, like the spirit of that was never so that people would just line up out the fucking door for one restaurant. And everyone and just ignore everything else until sufficiently cloudy online influencer says, no, I like this place.
And I'm, right. I'm
like, God damn, this whole culture is so juvenile and conformist, but somehow somehow they've co-opted the idea of conformity and rebellion, and it almost feels inverse. Do you know what I mean? Like conformity almost is now designed to feel like
subversive.
Rebellion. Subversive. Yeah. It's got that built in. It gives you the desire to be subversive and unique and cool and stuff built into the behavior, which is just total it's just total profit driven conformity.
Because we've worshipped money for so long. We've worshipped the idea of wealth. So if like all of culture is now behind a paywall. So it's sad in a way. I thought about this a lot when we were talking about Disney and why I particularly hate Disney so much. Like commodifying culture means that you have to have money or you literally are not part of the culture.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of people who are very, very alienated. We know as a generation, like they're not going to be in a position to be like, it's hard to be able to look someone young in the eye and say like, no, you got to work hard and save for what? Good question. I don't even fucking know. And just to be part of something, you now have to pay the toll. You got to have a little cash. You got to have a little time to stand in line or whatever the hell. You got to be part of the game, or you have nothing. Like I always thought, culture was the thing that could like culture is the thing between people that inherently does not have property rights to it.
I think you're right. I mean, there's almost the sense of, because I know like younger people are having and I don't blame them at all on this account. I think people who mock them for this are actually extremely dense about the nature of how things work in life now. But like when you're in your 20s, staring down the next four decades of your life as the kind of like toil and kind of meaningless work that you're doing in your 20s, extrapolate that out for 40 more years, kind of feels I think there's a bit of like vertigo there where it's like, wait, really? I'm just going to be doing this for fucking why? You know?
Right.
And
I think I got 25 years left on my bid. I don't fucking know how to keep the wheels on this bus for that long.
Yeah. Yeah.
I really like that's I'm not even being exa- I'm not exaggerating. I literally do not know how to mentally model that next quarter century.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know how to, like, given how chaotic everything is. So even if I, like, was like, okay, you know what? Grind it out, and then I can enjoy a couple of years of retirement before I finally shuffle off this mortal coil. Fine. I committed to that. I still don't know how to plan for that. There is no planning for this.
Yeah.
And if somebody in their early 20s, they've got 40 years left on, they've got almost a half century left to go. I don't blame them for just saying, you know what? Fuck it. $9 tea. Who gives a shit?
Yeah. Yep. That's why I think that I still think. Well, anyway, before I get to, I think this idea of work being meaningful and it's like that's all gone. Like I don't think young people even really consider, remunerative work as. You know, the careerist mindset, and by careerist, I mean, I've used that word a lot, but I haven't really explained what I mean by it. But it's basically when you approach your working life as the sort of like spine of your identity, you know, like you are fundamentally defined by your position, your professional position. That's the starting point of who you are. And then sort of everything flows from there in terms of your status and your family and all that stuff. It's all built around your career status. And that's why I think a lot of people have a hard time. Like, that's why we see articles like, oh, I don't want to live past 75 because, life loses meaning if I'm not being, an active contributor in the workforce, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And that careerism is why I think people can't see past, it's given careers a lot of problems because who wants to find your identity in being the assistant vice president of such and such thing? You know what I mean? Or whatever. Like, who gives a shit? But the younger people, I feel like that's not, they're not even taking to that. Like, they're not even buying in. They're just rejecting the whole concept outright. But then you still need money. And I think like the concept of money now is it's almost like just buying tokens to the arcade and trying to hit wins with that. You know what I mean? Like, they're kind
of
like,
yeah, it's a complete gambling economy for, first of all.
Yeah.
Everyone's looking, it's
for
Squid Game.
Everyone's trying to come out with a viral hit of some sort.
Yeah. Everyone wants that golden piggy bank for one thing. I think money's been pretty thoroughly exposed as government scrip.
Yeah.
It's easily manipulated. It's easily taken away. It's not really ours, even what little we do get of it. So, you know, what's the point hanging your hat on it in trying to sacrifice your life to earn as much of it or whatever? It's a scam economy. The social contract has broken down.
You know, what's funny is like people are so black-pilled about money too. It's like, I remember I was talking on Twitter with some, I was just saying like, yeah, you know, you say rich people are miserable, but all the wealthy people I know are actually pretty happy. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to glorify wealth. I'm just saying the wealthy people I know, pretty happy. Okay. I mean, their problems are different and I don't think they would trade places with someone without money. I'm just saying. Okay.
Right.
And they said, what do you call wealthy? And I said, you know, somewhere seven to eight figures. I don't know specifically, but seven to eight figures, you know. And they're like, on what planet and in what currency could that even be remotely considered rich? And I'm like, okay, so you're the guy that's like, you're not rich until you have nine figures or 10 figures. And I'm like, you know what? That's built into, that cynicism is built into the system of money too, to be like, to be wealthy is so, you have to be literally billionaire status to be rich.
Stratospheric
wealth. And anything other than that is pedestrian whatever. And I'm like, okay, but you probably don't have any money.
Right.
And you know what I mean? Like, so the concept of being like well-to-do, meaning if I work hard, I'll be able to achieve enough success that like I feel like a well-to-do person. Like, you know, I don't mm-hmm. have money. That sense has been inflated away where it's like, no, like, and I get it. I'm not arguing against them. I'm just saying, like, there is the sense of either you go full fucking oligarch or you're just a loser like the rest of us. Right. And that's sad. It's sad to see, like, there's not even a perception of there being, you know, enough for me. Mm-hmm. Right? I don't have to be fucking Jeff Bezos. I don't have to live in a yacht with my synthetic wife. But, like, I don't care about
that. She's been looking better lately.
Yeah, she's got the new upgrades. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The more human skin. Yeah. they've been coming a long way on these polymers, man. That was probably part of the prenup package.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah, no, I get that. It's people who I know, you know, they have a fair bit of money and they're still like, it's sad in a way.
Yeah.
Like, I know we're all strapped for, I know we're all feeling the pressure and the future seems very, very uncertain, but these are people who have like a solid, like 8 figures in the bank and they're nobody's making them miserable except themselves because they're like, oh my God, you know, I just don't have enough or something. Like, I don't know where I'm exactly going with this. It's that the entire way we think about how we relate to money has changed. And like, I kind of wanted to talk through that a little bit because I'm starting to see like, there's a difference between how I relate to money and how my parents relate to money.
Right. Okay.
I'm sure you've noticed that too, between you and your parents or other people in your family. I don't know.
Yeah. There's huge differences. For sure.
Yeah. Like for my parents, you know, they were immigrants. They came on student visas to go get PhDs at UCLA. So they were like destined to be white collars and they did okay for themselves. They earned in, you know, Reagan's 80s in California. Like they did okay. They see money as a risk hedge. Like it's not about showing off. It's not about status. It's literally about like being able to dig a deeper moat so you can't get fucked with.
Yeah, you mean in terms of job loss or illness or, you know, any of the sort of like things that might derail
my parents both were classic boomers. They had basically like one or two jobs in their entire careers. So it's not like job loss was the thing. It literally is like the Japanese might fuck us up again. Mm-hmm. That kind of just that thing. Like they were both born during the Japanese occupation. So I get that. Like that's probably just bone deep. I don't know. I don't know. How do your parents think about it?
Money. Yeah. I'm not sure. I think they're definitely not. My parents are like, definitely not driven by status. They do not think of money as a status competition, and they tend to be very quiet about money. So I don't know how much money they have. They don't talk about it. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, money's never been a problem for them. One, because their lifestyle is so modest that their income to spend has always been completely biased towards saving, and as far as I know, they don't really think about money anymore because they're in their 80s. Like the rest of their life is more than covered off by money. Okay.
It's on autopilot.
I mean, their income is still just as high as it was then prior to retirement because they were in that boomer generation that had, you know, the best retirement benefits that, you know, none of us are going to see. Right?
Yeah. My mom shared a little bit just because like she was doing some restructuring, you know, looking at finances and stuff. And she was sharing that like, her pension is like 80% of her highest earning year ever.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Teaching.
That's how they do
it. And that's stacked with like dividend returns and like social security and this and that. Yeah. She stands to actually make more than what she's doing now.
Yeah.
Plus she's still working. So, you know,
yeah, my mom has she was on the federal pension when they still had that. It's much, there's still a federal pension, but it's much, it's not as good as it used to be. But yeah, it's like, yeah. That, like 80 or 90% of your three average of your three highest years. Right. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, like, you know, I think my father was, he was earning his pension before he retired. So he was getting paid his fucking salary plus a pension. You know, this stuff. I mean, like, they really gave out fucking great benefits to themselves, that generation, that we're not going to see. So I think, I don't know, in a way, my parents are probably almost more, like, relaxed about money than I am, because I'm not going to have any of that stuff.
Right.
You know what I mean? So my view of money is probably almost more like your parents now, where I'm like, yeah, it's a wall that you've got to, you know, stack to protect yourself, because there's nothing else you can really rely on.
These fucking barbarians and crypto nuts are going to try to come take it all. Yeah.
You know, and who knows what the economy is going to be like. I don't really have faith that this is a very self-sustaining economy. Mm-hmm. And who knows, like, what the future is going to be for, like, careerists like me and our ability to make lots of money. So I feel like, I mean, I could be totally wrong and, you know, everything's going to be fine. However, I feel like this last decade or so has gone in my direction rather than the other way, in terms of me thinking things are going wrong. Like, I think things are heading towards what I've always feared and will continue to be like that. So in a way, I feel like, you know, you don't want to live life in a state of equilibrium, to say, as long as the cash flow, like, if you look at life through a cash flow lens, it's like, I've got enough money coming in to just to cover my spend on sort of an instantaneous time basis, and so everything's fine. I'm like, I don't know. I think you have to start really seeing it in terms of balance sheet, because it's like, I think your parents' view of money as a safety net kind of thing is more of a hard balance sheet view of money as a balance sheet asset, versus a cash flow thing of saying, as long as I have enough money coming in per month to cover my expenses for the month, then my income to spend ratio is sufficiently balanced.
Good.
You know what I mean? Because that's an instantaneous time. That's a velocity thing. And that requires a lot of faith that you're going to be able to keep this machine moving at that rate indefinitely. Whereas if you're worried that the future is going to be there's going to be discontinuities and major disruptions, you better think about your balance sheet and say, do I have enough assets to service and cover my liabilities, rather than does my income cover off my spending?
Right. And,
you know, because spending you can reduce, but your liabilities are your liabilities. That's your healthcare. That's your mortgage. That's, you know, all that stuff. That doesn't go away. And that's not really spending. That's just, those are liabilities of life.
Right.
You know, so,
you know, which kid do I like better?
Yeah, exactly.
this one looks like he's going to be expensive. We'll figure out somewhere to put him later.
We should dig deeper into this. Should we transition this into the bonus?
And yeah,
we'll
sure.
Talk about, we'll talk about money. Okay, so that's your episode for this week. To access bonus pods and such, which we do every week, go to patreon.com.
To hear us talk about money, give us some.
Yeah, exactly. And and we'll figure out fun things to do with it. You know, we sometimes give it away when one of our wonderful patrons decides to start a nonprofit project or something like that. We'll support you. If you come on the pod, I'll buy you drinks and dinner, you know, whatever. All right. So we'll see you on the bonus pod. Okay.
Bye.